Welcome to Wild Connection, the podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jennifer Vertelin. I'm a scientist and author that studies animal behavior. I'm passionate about animals and exploring the complexity of their lives, their intelligence, relationships, families, social connections, and emotions. I also love helping people reconnect with nature to live better lives. This podcast is about you, other animals, and how we're all connected in this wild and crazy thing called life. Hey, everybody, welcome back to Wild Connection, the podcast. There's been a tiny bit of a break because I've been in the jungle chasing after mountain gorillas. But we're back and we are kicking off with a very cool episode about koalas. I recently was in Madagascar, and what was amazing to me about being in Madagascar is there's many, many strange creatures. I mean, lemurs, let's face it, look a little bit like aliens. But the thing that struck me was there's nothing poisonous. I don't even think there's a plant that can cause a problem. And yet you go to another island, Australia, and it seems like they got all the poisonous things. They even have a poisonous mammal. And no, that's not koalas. It's the platypus. The platypus is a really strange, strange animal. Not only is it one of the few mammals that produces venom, but it also lays eggs. So this is very strange indeed. And the strangeness of Australia isn't limited to platypuses. I'm going to throw koalas into the mix as well. The koala is only one species. There is no other family member, but its closest living relative is the common wombat. They're currently listed as vulnerable by the IUCN, and their numbers are declining. They eat leaves that are poisonous, and while we might like eucalyptus oil for its health benefits, that is the primary diet of the koala. And eucalyptus leaves are kind of toxic, but they have a special way of dealing with this poison. As you can see, there are many, many interesting and strange facts about the koala. And to tell us all about them and why they're so spectacular is my guest, author Danielle Claude. And we're going to talk to her about her book, Koalas, A Natural History and an Uncertain Future. Hey, everybody, welcome back to Wild Connection, the podcast. I am excited to bring on this next guest, nature writer Danielle Claude. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
You know, you just have released a new book. You have other books, but this latest book is Koalas, A Natural History and an Uncertain Future. And, you know, before we dive into the book, I would love for my audience to get to know a little bit about you and your background. Can you share a little bit about where you're from, where you live?
Sure. Well, I live in Australia, which is pretty expected for someone writing about koalas. But I live on the south coast of Australia, so kind of in the middle of the continent, right on the bottom coastline. So, yeah, I live in an area that's got a lot of koalas, and they, you know, I literally have them in my backyard, which is a pretty lucky thing to have, I guess. We don't see them all that often, but yes. And my background, I trained in zoology and conservation biology and animal behavior, but I've pretty much worked as a writer, a nature writer, a science writer, I suppose, for most of my career. So that's really what I focus on, is writing about all the amazing sort of natural history stories that are out there.
And we need people to be doing that. And you and I sort of share that passion. I'm curious, you know, when you were growing up, connect to the natural world, and how has that influenced the way you connect now?
Yeah, so I did have a fairly unusual childhood, to be fair. My dad was a boat builder, and his dream was to build a boat and sail around Australia and live on the boat. So for much of my childhood, I was either living on a half-built boat or actually living on a boat and sailing around the Australian coast. And the thing that really creates is that, you know, you visit a lot of places that other people don't get to. So a lot of the anchorages and mooring places are inaccessible by road. So it really opened my eyes to a whole heap of wilderness areas. And I think also living on a boat also really puts you in very close contact with nature, because you're at the mercy of the weather to a very much greater extent than you are on the land. And I think that sort of has really shaped the way that I think about the natural world and the connection I have with it.
Yeah. And in the book, Koalas, A Natural History and Uncertain Future, you talk about how, you know, two-legged primates, maybe with our other primate cousins, are not real fans of inclement weather and being at its mercy. But I'm curious, what led you to choose koalas? What motivated you to write this book?
Yeah, look, koalas are a really interesting species because they're so well known. You know, they're internationally famous. So they're one of our most recognized species. And yet for both Australians and for overseas, people who are from other countries. But we really don't know much about them beyond their pretty face on a postcard kind of thing. You know, they're cute, they're fluffy, they got big ears, and, you know, they look cuddly. But beyond that, we know very little about them. And I think most Australians know very little about them either. So I was really interested to learn more about them. And I think the driving question for me was really, you know, we've got a lot of koalas where I live. We have one of the highest populations, the highest density koala populations in the country. And yet on the east coast of Australia, you know, down through the major cities of Brisbane and Sydney, koalas are under threat, you know, and are declining quite dramatically. And, you know, we hear lots of news reports of them being in danger of extinction, but, you know, only local extinction on the East Coast. Elsewhere, they're quite abundant. So that was an anomaly I really wanted to answer. And the other driving force was, of course, the bushfires. So I live in a very bushfire-prone area. We had what we call a small fire that burnt through the local reserve in our area. And there are a lot of koalas living in that reserve. So, you know, the question of what happens to them, how do they cope, what's the impact of the increasing frequency of bushfires for their long-term survival.
Yeah, and those are all really important questions that are answered in the book. But I really love the way you describe some of the koalas. You use words like sashaying and indignant, and that sort of infuses a richness into the behaviors and the demeanor that I think helps us connect with them. And you mentioned that many people are fascinated by them, even if we don't know much about them. What do you think it is about them that is such a draw for so many people? Is it simply the big head and the seemingly wobbly bodies that look like a teddy bear?
That is a big draw card. You know, they definitely do have an appeal. The interesting thing I think about koalas is that they didn't have that strong appeal when Europeans first arrived in their country. You know, a lot of Australian animals attracted a lot of attention when Europeans first arrived here. You know, kangaroos, platypus, wombats even. But koalas, nothing. There's very little interest in them at all, which seems remarkable now. And I think a big factor in the modern appreciation for koalas or enthusiasm for koalas does come from children's book writers. So, you know, when we started to get children's books being written about koalas and the fate of koalas and how, you know, precious they were. Blinky Bill is a very famous Australian children's book. A lot of that was written in response to concern over them going extinct in the you know, early 1900s. And there they're depicted as, you know, childlike characters. So we have that sort of connection. And of course, they are the size of a 3 or 4 year old child, you know, and the way they climb trees means that they like being picked up. Young koalas like to be carried by their mothers. So when they're abandoned, they will want someone to pick them up because that makes them feel safe. Koalas like to be holding a tree. If a tree's not available, a person will do, you know. so there's a lot of features of them, I think, that really appeal. You know, they've got that forward-facing face, you know, the big round face. They do they do look at you in a particular way that's really appealing. So there's a lot of things about them that I think we find they naturally trigger a parental instinct, I suppose we could call it.
Yeah, and I think that's why my publisher decided to put them on the cover of Raised by Animals, my second book. It's koalas. I don't actually talk about koalas in the book, but I think it's the sort of baby face, big eyes, you know. But not everyone loves koalas. One of the animals that I study is prairie dogs, and this animal also evokes really strong emotions that are on opposite ends of the spectrum. And so where does this sort of bipolar feeling about koalas come from?
Yeah, I guess there's a couple of things there. I mean, obviously, if you have anything to do with trees, you might be less keen on koalas. I mean, they're generally a fairly innocuous animal. They don't do much damage. They don't cause major problems. But in some areas where their populations are booming, they can damage the trees and overgraze the trees. So foresters have a few issues with them. Sometimes foresters are not so keen on them. If they start eating their plantation trees, even if they're not having a negative impact on the tree, it makes it difficult for them to harvest the trees. So there's often a lot of conflict between people who want to clear land and clear forest versus people who want to protect forest. So it's that, you know, development, extraction industry, agriculture battle, not so much over the koala, but simply because the koala is a figurehead for habitat protection. So that can be a problem. I guess the other thing, I guess, is that because koalas are so cute and cuddly, people sometimes will react against that. And Australians have a really quick response to the tall poppy syndrome, you know. So if something's too popular, then you've got to dismiss it as a negative.
Okay.
So there's that tendency as well. So they like to talk about how they koalas will wee on you in a tree, which is true. They do. They're really undiscriminating like that. So if you happen to stand under one, that's not such a good idea. But, you know, or that they scratch you. And they do have big claws. They can inflict nasty wounds if you get one in a corner where it doesn't want to be. But by and large, koalas are pretty relaxed, easygoing animals. So sure, they can be dangerous like any wild animal, and they shouldn't be approached or chased or anything like that. But if you leave them be, they're quite contented.
Right.
Well,
I mean, I've been peed on by a bee. Not a bee. That would be weird. A bird. And a butterfly. I'm pretty sure it was pee from the butterfly. I'm pretty sure.
Wow.
But yeah, but you know, so any animal that you're going to interact with, at some point you're going to have some kind of pee on you at some point.
Yes, and anybody who works with animals knows that that's just a natural part of the process.
Exactly. You know, now you had some interesting adventures with koala fossils, and I won't give away all of these wonderful elements in the book, but I learned a lot. And so can you help orient the audience to the family tree of koalas? And if the koala that we know of as koala now originated in Australia, or do they actually have a close relative on another continent?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, the interesting thing about Australian animals is that a large proportion of our mammals are marsupials, which are a very distinctive, less well-known group of animals. To Australians, they're the dominant type of mammal, but to the rest of the world, they're not. So the mammal tree split quite early in the evolutionary history between into marsupials and eutherian, or what we often call placental mammals. So like humans, like dogs, like cats, like, you know, all the common animals, elephants, the whales, all of that stuff. So that was a very early split, and marsupials have dominated in Australia because Australia has been an isolated landmass separated from the other continents for a very long time. So it's retained the marsupials. But the only other place that has a lot of marsupials is is South America. And so people will be more familiar with that from the opossums. And of course, there's one or two opossums that have sort of made it up into North America. So, you know, the Virginia opossum. There's also a laboratory opossum, which is a strange concept, but that's used widely in scientific research. So there's a couple of those opossums, but South America is actually full of an amazing array of opossums. I had no idea how diverse they were until I started looking at them. And it was really interesting. I read a book on, that's just come out, about opossum biology. And I was looking through it and I was thinking, wow, these are proper mammals, you know, because they look familiar. They are marsupials and they have characteristics that they share with Australian marsupials. So it was really strange. I'm not used to seeing things that aren't Australian mammals that look like Australian mammals or have things in common. But, you know, Australia's marsupials are incredibly diverse. So we have everything from the smallest mammals you can get, you know, the tiny little planigales that live in cracks in clay, to kangaroos that stand taller than a human. So, you know, we've got a really wide array of beasts, including the koala. The koala's closest living relative is the wombat, which is a ground-dwelling animal. But it, in some ways it looks similar because it's got that sort of short, stocky body, no tail, you know, around head. They're quite characterful beasts as well, but they only live in the ground. They live in burrows, so very different behavior. But the longer term history of koalas is really interesting because, you know, Australia has a rich megafaunal history. And when we think about megafauna, we tend to think about, you know, the Ice Age mammals, the woolly mammoths, the saber-toothed tigers, those sorts of giant sloths. Of course, Australia doesn't have those because they're all placental largely, but we do have a whole heap of marsupial megafauna, and the biggest of those, the diprotodons, which were big two-ton grazing animals, looked a bit like a giant bear, I guess you could call it, probably a lot more easygoing. but they are actually relatives of koalas. So, you know, and Thylacoleo, which was a predatory tree-dwelling marsupial, so a bit like a killer possum, I guess you'd call it, about the size of a leopard. So, you know, really strange, unusual animals. And these are all relatives of the koalas. So, you know, in the past, they've had a much more diverse history. And of course, now we've only got one species of koala, whereas in the past, we've had many other species of koalas.
Right.
So they're probably a lot more diverse than we think.
Well, and it's kind of like humans, right? We have, you know, anatomically modern humans, but we're sort of the last ones that made it through the last, you know, round of pruning of that tree. So when people think of koalas, I think we're so used to just seeing a picture of them or seeing them just hanging on to a tree. And that doesn't give us a really good sense of what day-to-day life is like for a koala. So what does a day in the life of a koala look like?
It has to be said that a day in the life of a koala largely consists of sleeping. They are masters of the art of sleeping. They sleep in the most amazing, relaxed positions, right at the top of trees. They don't just, you know, curl up in a ball and attach themselves tightly to a branch. They sprawl, they flop. It's just amazing the way they sleep, you know, and especially in hot climates, they just sprawl out to keep cool. And I don't know how they stay up the trees. They're quite remarkable like that. But they do spend, you know, a good more than 90% of their time asleep. And that's actually led to some interesting assumptions about koalas. So people have often assumed that because they sleep all the time, that's because they have a low nutrient diet, because they eat eucalyptus leaves, which are very fibrous and highly toxic to most mammals. But in actual fact, I don't think that's true. I think they sleep because they can. They're sitting up in a tree, they're safe from predators. Their best strategy to avoid predators in a tree is to stay still. They've got all the food they want within easy reach, so they simply eat as much as they need and then they go to sleep and digest their dinner. It sounds like a pretty good life to me.
Well, and you know, I think being a leaf eater does contribute to not being very, very active, but I'm not sure that it's because of nutrition. But you know, mountain gorillas are another example. Like, I waited my whole life to study mountain gorillas, and now here I am doing that in windy, impenetrable forest. And it turns out they don't do a whole lot. Right? They also climb trees, and I do not know how they rest precariously, like a 400-pound silverback resting precariously on a branch, you know, is enough to make my heart stop. But, you know, there's a lot of laying around, eating. And then, you know, if you have to move, you move to go find more leaves. The only exception for the gorillas on really moving quickly is if there's fruit somewhere. Yeah. That they're chasing, and nothing's really predating on them. So they're not in a big rush or having to be furtive and alert all the time. Mm-hmm. But is there some, you know, truth to being a leaf eater causing you to be sort of slower moving and less active?
Yeah, I think it's just, you know, moving around in the trees is quite energetically costly as well. You know, it's not as easy as walking on the flat where your weight is always supported. You know, they're always carrying their weight as they're up in the trees. I think that is a cost. Going up and down trees is a massive cost. So that's not something they're going to want to do in a hurry. If they can move between trees through the canopy, they will, but they need the trees to be close enough together. They do jump, actually. Koalas, they can be quite acrobatic. In the 5% of the time they're awake, you know, if you're lucky to catch them in that half hour, they're really quite active.
Okay, wow, half hour. Okay. Well, you know, the eucalyptus, you brought that up, and you brought up how many people have thought that the challenges with digesting the toxins in the eucalyptus could be contributing. Setting aside disagreeing with that, which, you know, I think we don't really know. But what are some of those challenges in dealing with eucalyptus in particular? And how do, you know, those little jelly bean baby koalas develop the ability to handle their veggies?
Yeah, yeah. Look, it's a really good question. You know, eucalyptus obviously present the same challenges as any fibrous plant material for mammals, in that mammals don't have the digestive system needed to break down cellulose in the leaves. So they have to have a special suite of microbes to assist them to do that. So all mammals face that challenge. I guess the interesting thing with koalas is that eucalyptus are not just a single tree. You know, they're just not one tree species. They're 900 tree species. They're an incredibly diverse forest across Australia. And koalas, remarkably, have adapted to feed on a great many of them. Not all of them, but they're known to feed on at least 70 species. And any one koala will be eating between 3 and 10 species of eucalypt. And that means that the particular structure of the eucalypt leaf is very distinct. And they've evolved a whole heap of, you know, mechanisms to try and stop animals from eating them, which the koala then has to overcome. So in addition to digesting the specific cellulose and lignin that's in the leaves, they are tough leaves to eat as well. They've also got to deal with the toxins in eucalypt. So most mammals find eucalypt toxins make them feel nauseous. So they don't eat very many of them before they start to feel sick. I've not tried that myself, but not advisable. But yeah, they're not great. So yeah, koalas have an amazing liver, which seems to have a double dose of genes for removing toxins. So that's how they deal with the eucalypt toxins. And the cellulose, they've evolved, you know, we know lots of mammals have amazing multiple stomach chambers and all those sorts of things. Koalas use their cecum, which is in humans, that's the appendix. And our appendix is only about the size of our thumb. But in koalas, it's, you know, almost 2 meters long. So it's this huge sort of long sock, you know, of the digestive system. And when they chew up the eucalypt leaves, they chew them up into very fine particles. The bigger particles just go straight down through the normal digestive system, but they make a sort of a soup of the fine particles that sweep into the cecum, and they stay there for up to a week in this microbial soup, which then digests the leaves and gets the nutrient out. So that's basically how the koala digestive system works. But of course, every baby koala is born, as you said, as a jelly bean, a tiny little pinky, as they call them. And they crawl, they have to crawl up when they're born from through the mother's fur and get into her pouch and attach themselves to the nipple, and they stay there attached to the nipple so firmly they don't come off. They're completely firmly wedded. Early scientists thought that they grew out of the nipple, in fact, because they're so firmly wedded to it. Wow. So they stay there until they're big enough to exit the pouch, and that's about the same stage of development that most mammals are born. So basically the marsupials have a second pregnancy in the pouch, which, speaking as a mother, I think that's an excellent Echelon strategy, we really dip down having internal pregnancies. I think the pouch idea is fantastic. And it will be quite a little while before the Joey koala will want to eat leaves. I'll mess around with them, but they won't eat them. And they have to be inoculated with the particular bacteria they need for the forest they live in. So, and what happens is that at some point when the mother decides it's time to wean her baby, she will evacuate her cecum. So it's turning off the normal digestive system and it's emptying a big pile of microbial green soup. So this is not an attractive thing to have happen because the baby's basically eating this green slop and they absolutely love it. They really get skinned. They're covered in green slime.
Now I'm thinking maybe we did luck out in dipping out of this whole primordial soup slime situation.
It's one of the messier parts of koala biology, but very effective. So they then become inoculated with the right bacteria, and from that moment on, they enthusiastically eat gum leaves, eucalypt leaves.
Well, so then that raises a question for me: if for some reason a Joey koala is separated from its mom prior to this inoculation, do they ever develop the ability to eat eucalyptus leaves?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And I suspect this is one reason why, you know, in the early days when people tried to keep koalas in captivity, they'd feed them all the most inappropriate things. You know, they'd feed them tea leaves and peppermints and all sorts of strange things, alcohol, goodness knows what, you know, and they'd try and feed them the way they feed other herbivores. You know, they think they could just eat, you know, pellets like we feed goats or something. But koalas do not operate that way. They have to have fresh gum leaves and they will not eat anything else. But you can keep a joey alive on milk for quite a long time. And I think that's probably what happened with a lot of those captive animals. But over time, they will sicken and ultimately die. And that's a problem not just for young joeys, but, you know, for older animals. If they're moved from one forest to another, they may not have the right microbes to digest the particular trees that they're now being fed. So they can eat but not get any nutrients. And it's quite remarkable. Some trees that scientists have actually found that you end up with a net deficit if the koala eats them. So the koalas will eat the trees, but they're actually losing energy in doing so because of the tree's defense mechanisms. So it's really, really important that koalas have the right sort of trees to feed on. And that's why they're so expensive to keep in zoos overseas, because they have to grow exactly the right trees and a wide variety of trees, because koalas will just decide, seemingly for no reason at all, that a tree that they have been feeding on for weeks is suddenly no good. And maybe that's a change in the nutrient balance. Maybe that's a change in the toxicity. We don't know. Well, what we do know is that you just have to give them something else until you find something they like. So they're incredibly fussy. There are methods, you know, traditionally zookeepers will inoculate baby marsupials generally with pellets, so fecal pellets from other animals will also contain those microbes. It's not as rich as the pap that the mother produces, but it will inoculate babies. And this is a well-known medical technique that we even use in humans. So we have medical processes that re-inoculate our digestive system if we've lost our bacteria through, say, antibiotics, extreme antibiotics or something like that. So we do this with humans. We do it a slightly a nicer way than koalas do. They tend to put it in a nice little tablet for you.
Right. Well, and we're finding, you know, that fecal transplants are curing lots of ailments, both mental and physical. So this is a growing area of research. And I was sort of imagining, there could be, if koalas have to move from this forest to that forest, can we always like secure a little bit of this cecum expulsion from a different individual and use it to inoculate, you know, those that have to be moved, because that may be happening in their future, which we'll get to. One thing that occurred to me when I was reading your book, Koalas, A Natural History and an Uncertain Future, was, you know, I had Dr. Kenny Trevelyan on the show back in 2021, and it seems like a lot of mammals in Australia are glowing like they're attending a rave party. Is there any evidence that koalas are bioluminescent?
This is a really interesting one, a very popular thing to talk about. And yeah, I did talk to one of my colleagues who's an expert in bioluminescence about this. And yeah, I got a very, very long detailed lecture on the subject about how, generally speaking, keratin is bioluminescent. It's a very common thing to, not bioluminescent, but it fluoresces under UV light. So it's important to distinguish between bioluminescence,
okay,
which is generated by the animal, so light being generated, versus fluorescence, which is a response to UV light. So the argument is that actually quite a lot of animals have fluorescence. It's probably species specific, but whether it actually forms any kind of function is another matter. Qualifier I looked at didn't fluoresce, but that might have been age related. I don't know, all the strengths of the UV torch I had. But I think some people have found that it does, but not as well as the platypus and some of the other animals. I think quite possibly, you know, some of these things, teeth and bone, all fluoresce. There's no adaptive function for that. It's just a feature of the particular proteins that they're built with, and there's no negative reason for them to not do this. So there's no selection pressure operating on it, basically. I think the thing with UV reflection is that during the day, there's too much UV, so you don't see that fluorescence. And at night, there's no UV and you can't see it either. So there's only a very small window where this is a functional thing. And the one place where it is say birds of prey or animals that are hunting just on that dawn dusk crest, and then you can actually demonstrate that they can see the UV reflection. So it's not the fluorescing, but it's just the reflection in natural light. And at that point in time, there's an advantage for hunters and the hunted in terms of how much they express that. But most of the time, it's just not being selected for. So it pops up in a lot of animals and doesn't pop up in others, but it possibly doesn't mean much.
I really appreciate that distinction for folks, and including myself, bioluminescence versus fluorescence. And the function of something, something can just be there, but if it doesn't have a price, there's no reason to try to get rid of it at all. That's a really great explanation. Now, I was curious about koalas. Are they big communicators? Are there any chatty Cathys out there? Because I remember seeing a video of, I don't know if it was a male, because I don't actually know how you tell the difference between a male and a female. Maybe you can fill me in. But there was two individuals and there was sort of a dispute happening about ownership of a tree, and one was, you know, evicted essentially and sat at the base of the tree seemingly screaming in frustration. And I felt quite bad for this individual. Like, you just were like, oh, that's terrible. And you could just see the, like, you know, people can't see me doing this, but it's, imagine that you're just pitching a fit, a tantrum. And that's what, but I was so surprised by the sounds that came out of this individual. So can you talk a little bit about communication?
Yeah, they are quite vocal animals. There's a video of that particular interaction. You can see, usually if you put in koala crying, you'll get that video. And it does sound like a cry, and that's a classic thing for a young joey to do. So that individual is probably a young joey that's trying to find a new tree. It's been booted out by its mother. The koala that booted it out is a male. You can see it. He's got a big chest gland, so they've got a brown streak on their chest. And it's also, you also hear that male bellowing, which is something males do. So they produce this guttural, wheezy bellow that you can hear in the spring in Australian forests. So you know that there are koalas around because they're doing this big bellowing over long distances. But they do produce a wide range of sounds, and certainly in the breeding season you hear a lot of noise. So their mating is not particularly amicable. There's a lot of arguing going on, and that involves the female screaming, and it's a terrible racket. So koalas have a induced ovulation, so the males come on to become interested in mating before the females do, and the females take a little while to warm up. So there's a lot of, you know, rejections going on before they finally accept their
don't we all? I mean, we all need a little warming up, and there's plenty of rejection being doled out. That's on the human side of things too.
Yeah. So there is a terrible racket going on. And of course, they do fight as well. So the males will fight. They will battle over trees. They don't like sharing their trees with other koalas. You know, they can live amicably if there's an abundant food supply. So this seems to be driven a lot by food supply. So koalas do communicate a lot by chemical signaling. So that big mark on the scent marking that the males do, they wee on the tree that they've been on. So koalas will always sniff a tree before they go up it because they want to know if anyone else is there.
Right.
They want to climb that tree and then find someone else is there. They'd rather go and find another tree. And they use that to identify whether the inhabitant of that tree is, you know, a breeding female, a breeding male, you know, what sort of animal it is. They assess each other's bellows in terms of size. So there's a lot of long distance communication going on with koalas. But of course, when they do come into contact, and if they're not being antagonistic to each other, it's quite sweet because they bump noses, and that's a really endearing feature of koalas. They'll bump nose with people as well when they interact. So yeah, it's just gorgeous.
Have you had your nose bumped?
No, I haven't, I'm afraid. That close contact with a koala, but yeah, they are known to do that, so it's very sweet.
Okay, that brings up a lot. So are they territorial? Like, meaning, like, I'm a koala and I have this range and I own these trees? Or is it just, I own the tree I'm in right now as long as nobody bigger can come and get me out of the tree?
Yeah, the spatial distancing for koalas is completely dependent on the forest they're in. And because the forests they're in are so diverse and variable, it really depends where they are. So in where I live, you can have multiple koalas in a tree. That's not uncommon. And, you know, in some of the prime areas and the favorite feed trees, you can get three or four koalas in a tree. Elsewhere, you will have one koala per 100 hectares. Wow. So incredibly spaced out. So it really depends a lot on where you are. I guess if we talk about the middling range, it's common to have, you know, three or four female koalas in neighbouring ranges. They're not territories per se. They do overlap, but they're sort of loose ranges, and one male that might overlap those ranges. So, yeah, they're not territorial in the sense of defending their space, but if they happen to encounter another male, for example, there's definitely a fight on your hands. Females are probably less so, but still possibly prefer their own space. So they'll avoid each other for sure.
Okay. Now, as a fellow animal behavior person, I am, you know, I find my bliss just sitting and watching other animals for hours. When it comes to koalas, you mentioned at the beginning that, you know, they're still rather mysterious, and you're unpacking a lot of that mystery in your book. But do you think that the fact that they are so inactive, right, half an hour in a day, that it just takes longer to really get to know the ins and outs of as an individual or as a species, just because of the level of inactivity that they have?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're also predominantly nocturnal. They are active occasionally during the day, but they're more active at night, and they live up really, really tall trees. You know, eucalypt trees are the tallest flowering hardwood in the world. Some of them are unbelievably tall, and even the, you know, we do have small ones, but koalas typically like being, you know, 30 or 40 metres up in the air. So all you can see is this tiny little grey bottom from the ground.
Yeah.
They're really hard to spot. You know, I've given myself a crick in the neck. Even when I know there's a koala in the tree, it takes me forever to find it. And sitting there watching it is not an easy thing to do. So, yeah, they are difficult animals to study. And they're widely dispersed, so they're hard to track and find. So that's why biologists spend a lot of time looking at koala poo, because it's easier to find.
Well, in general, we all spend a lot of time looking at poo. I mean, you can get so much information from poo. It's frightening.
You can. It's really interesting, the new work that's coming out using droppings and, you know, checking stress levels and health and all those sorts of things. You know, not just, you know, now they're doing genetic breakdowns of the species of trees they're eating, but also the species of bacteria that they have in their gut biome. So loads and loads of information. Yeah. Yeah. Who's great for that?
Well, it is. And I'm, you know, I'm deep in the world of gorilla poo myself. But I'm curious, you know, is there anything in particular that you did observe while you were writing this book or learned about koala behavior in particular that surprised you?
I guess the thing that really struck me, you know, koalas have a reputation for being dumb. So, you know, people will always say that. They're a bit stupid. They're slow. They're stupid. And there's a widespread belief that they have very small brains. So, you know, there's, you know, in the literature, people will often say their brain only takes up 60% of their skull space and it just basically rattles around in there. And I always thought that was really weird because that's generally not how biology works. If you've got a small brain, your skull shrinks. You know, we don't build things in biology that aren't being used.
Right. Or that knock around, you know, like,
yeah,
even in your, I mean, in our abdomen anatomy, if you remove some parts, you know, there creates some space and that can create some trouble. So we tend to pack stuff in pretty tightly.
We do, exactly. Mammal brains generally are fairly tightly packed in. You're right. It's not good for brains to be rattling around. That's a bad idea.
So, that will make you stupid.
So that's, you know, and people have said, oh, it's because they're, you know, they're eating toxic leaves that makes them have this small brain. They don't have much energy. They have to sleep a lot. So there's a whole sequence of events that makes us think that, but I'm actually not convinced that that's true. And recent studies have, you know, looking at actual MRIs of living koala brains and recently post-mortemed animals, so animals that have only died recently, finds that in actual fact their brains are perfectly average size for their body size. They take up most of the brain cavity. They may have a slightly thicker layer of fluid around the outside of the brain, which is probably an absorber, a buffer for when they fall out of the tree, which they have a remarkable capacity to survive extremely long drops. They're quite amazing. And they do suffer injuries from that, but they often survive, which is quite remarkable. But you know, as an animal behaviorist, I'm also interested in animal cognition and what animals are, how they're making decisions about the world. People, when they think about cognition, often think, oh, this means the animal's thinking, you know, or like we do, which is a sort of an internal dialogue we have running in our heads all the time. I'm not suggesting animals do that, but all animals have cognition. All animals think about what they're doing. They're responding to stimulus, processing information, making decisions about what they're going to do. And I'm interested in how koalas do that. And I do think that they must have a capacity for some kind of spatial mapping in order to navigate their complex environment, to know where food is, to revisit, you know, to know which trees they've visited in the past, what other animals are doing in their area. They're very, very observant animals. When they're in a tree, they watch very carefully what you're doing. It's another one of the appealing things is that if you look at a koala, you'll often see it's watching you as much as you're watching it. And they'll move, you know, if they've got a joey, they'll move around the other side of the tree so that you can't see the joey. So they're responding slowly and not very overtly, but they're definitely responding to humans. And they will utilize humans. There's famous examples of, you know, somebody seeing a koala up a tree that's in a flooded river and shooting a canoe across to the tree. And the koala climbs down the tree, hops in the canoe, and as they scoot the canoe across to the shore, it will walks up to the other end of the canoe and hops out, you know, thank you very much. That requires quite a lot of interpretation and foresight and planning to decide that that's a good action to take and to predict what the person is going to do. That's not a random piece of behavior.
No, and it's quite, you know, there's a big decision involved there, especially because I don't think koalas have any kind of history with canoes to even know what it's for, but yet they've seen, you know, there's this implicit understanding that it's helpful.
Yeah, so if we think about that in cognitive terms, that shows foresight and planning, which is an interesting thing to demonstrate in an animal. So it's not just responding randomly to its environment. And I think we've greatly underestimated koalas. We just haven't looked at it, really. People just don't ask that question because they're not clever the way humans are. They don't necessarily solve puzzles or, you know, explore their environment. They're not curious about, if you put a box in a koala's enclosure, it's not interested in the box. you know. But if you put something that it might find useful, like a bridge to somewhere else, it'll explore that. So it's just they've got their own particular interests in the world that aren't the same as ours.
A good lesson for all of us to even think about how we relate to each other.
Yes.
I know we're almost out of time, and this has been so wonderful. I have, you know, just two questions left. One is, recently I've been part of a sort of a working group that's been thinking about the impact of ecotourism on other species and what it's like for them to be watched. And you were mentioning, you know, that when you're watching a koala, you find, in fact, it's also watching you. And a lot of times, you know, I see posts of people holding koalas and taking selfies. And you talked about how koalas don't mind using humans as a tree, but do you think that these encounters, one, help conservation, and two, do you think that the koalas experience any kind of stress from being handled by different people, or do they just simply enjoy a good cuddle by a person?
Yeah, I think there's a big difference between wild koalas and ones that are kept in captivity that may well have been hand-reared. I think that, you know, in a reputable, any reputable zoo, for example, that runs koala encounters is very, very careful in their training. They select animals that are amiable to these interactions. Some animals, there's very big differences in temperament. Some koalas are really cranky and some koalas are really lovely and sweet. So they obviously choose the ones that are happy to do that. And they have a really limited window in which to do that. You know, they know that they're only going to get 15 minutes to half an hour out of a koala before it's decided it's had enough and it's ready for going to have another nap. So, you know, as soon as the koala moves off, they put it away and get another one out for the koala encounters. So I think as long as it's a reputable zoo that's managing its koalas well, there's not a great deal of stress involved in that. And it certainly does, I guess, help with the education. But the problem comes when you get koalas in the wild and then people want to handle them and they can cause all sorts of stress and damage. So, you know, it's a tricky balance, I think. My personal preference is to have a close encounter with a koala, but you don't necessarily need to cuddle it. And honestly, it may wee on you. So,
but you can't get chlamydia from it by holding it, can you?
No.
Okay, just don't touch your eyes afterwards.
Watch your hands.
Yes.
So, I think it is a slightly contentious issue, but I do think that, you know, generally speaking, koalas are not a species that are particularly problematic in that context. And they do seem to be pretty placid. We've got colleagues of mine at Flinders University who have just been doing studies on the impact of drones on koalas and what they think and measuring their heart rate and general stress levels. And they basically, the ones in, you know, the parks areas that are close to these activities have no response to the drones. Not interested, don't seem to care.
So that's great. You know. And maybe that brain power they have goes, is this something I need to worry about? Probably not. And they can just decide to ignore it. Well, thank you so much. You know, I hope everyone goes and gets a copy of Koalas, A Natural History and an Uncertain Future. We've only scratched the surface of all of this, everything that's packed into this book. And I know that this is not your only book. So I'm hoping I get to have you on to chat about some of the others. But for now, where can people find you, follow you, and connect with you?
Sure. I'm on social media. So they can follow me on Instagram or Facebook or Twitter. And my website is under my name. So it's danielleclode.com.au. It's an unusual name, so it's pretty easy to find me.
That's great. And I will make sure that I put links to all of that on the show notes. And thank you for reducing a bit of the mystery of koalas and sharing so much of their lives and yours with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a great pleasure.
You know, I'm not typically into physically interacting with wild animals, and I really don't support it. And I have to admit at the same time that as I listened to Danielle discuss nose bumping in koalas as a friendly hi hello, I kind of wish I could bump noses with a koala. Of course, since most of them carry chlamydia, that's ultimately going to be a hard pass. Now, if you want to find out where to get a copy of Koalas, A Natural History and an Uncertain Future, and see other books by Danielle, check out the show notes on my website, jennifervertelin.com, or on the podcast website, Wild Connection, the podcast on Podbean. I want to thank all the listeners for supporting this show and sticking with us, even though we had a bit of a break. I hope you'll continue to support the podcast by giving it a like and sharing it with your friends. Next week, we are shifting to hormones. Many people fail to realize how much of our lives are governed by hormones. We tend to think about them only at various critical life transitions or events like puberty or pregnancy, but hormones are much more than events. I talk with Dr. Randi Hutter Epstein about her book, Aroused: The History of Hormones and How They Control Just About Everything. And by the way, we mean that for men and women. If you're digging the show, subscribe and share it so others can enjoy it too. You can follow the show on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Also, follow the show on Twitter at Wild Connect Pod. You can also follow me on Twitter at Real Dr. Jen or on Instagram at Real Dr. Jen, where you can keep up with all the mountain gorilla adventures and other exciting developments. Thanks for listening.